afternoon. And I'm pretty sure, okay, mics. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Apparently, this mic does something, but I guess not enough. I might have to figure out if there's a way of fixing that. But I am somewhat amplified, and I have the volume turned all the way up on the thing. So I guess that's what I'll have to deal with, and maybe I can figure out something better for the situation. So hopefully you're here for CSO2. So we're going to go sort of a course introduction, some logistics, and maybe we'll start on the material, but probably just not. So talk about, like, what are we going to cover in this course? And I've kind of divided up our kind of big themes for the semester. And, well, themes of, I guess, varying sizes. Some of these are going to be bigger than others. Of things we're going to cover. And our first topic is going to be about automating building software. So you've done building software, like you compile things in CSO1. And we're going to talk more about things related to that and making that an easier process, and also talking about libraries and packaging libraries in a C context for convenient use. And kind of the primary tool we'll look at as kind of a case study in automating building software and something C-like is Make. And kind of the idea of Make is that once you configure it, you can have some programs. So in our example, I have this food.exe. And I run food.exe and I realize, gosh, this input function here, it just doesn't work the way I want it to. Let me fix that. So I open up my text editor. I realize that code is in readline.c. Let's fix that code, make it do what I want it to do. And now I need to make a new copy of food.exe, which has that code. And one thing I could do is I could just rerun all my compilation commands, hopefully typing them correctly each time and not forgetting any. Or if I've set up make, I can run the make command and it just figures out what commands need to be run. And you'll notice that in this example here, it's not running all the commands to build the program. We're doing something called incremental compilation. So I believe in CSO1, you saw object files in some vague way. And so here, we're running the command to produce one object file from a C file. But we're also running commands that use a whole bunch of other object files as a part of that. So we end up running this command that also uses terminal. It's in the wrong order, but the idea here is that we're, you know, that with this other command, we have these other files that we produced earlier that we aren't recompiling, so just terminal.l, and the reason we can do that is that we know, well, terminal.c didn't change, so I don't need to run a clang command for terminal.c, and make is smart enough to figure out, based on how you configure it, which is going to be our kind of first topic tomorrow, or Thursday, sorry, that, oh, that's not necessary. But we realize, oh, to produce this libreadline.a, which is going to be a library, we can use that existing terminal.o and the new readline.o to produce that readline.a, and then we can use that combined with some other object files we produced earlier to produce the foo.exe execute. So this make utility is automating this process of just doing what needs to be done. So for a small software project like this, that's not a big deal, but we apply the same kind of principle to something like, you know, Firefox. If I change some lines of code in Firefox and want to compile it again, that might be, you know, if I compile it all from scratch every time, that might take me an hour. Firefox is really big, it has lots of stuff in it, but with the right automation, like, we should just change what needs to be changed, just recompile little bits, And because object files kind of represent kind of one source file at a time, and we can combine them later with relatively minimal effort, that's going to make it a lot faster, even though we're producing the same executable, because we're not spending the effort of producing new assembly and machine code for most of the executable, just the parts we changed. Yes, question back there. Is there any way I can turn up my mic a little bit? Apparently not. Let me see if there are alternate mics, or if I can somehow mount this really close. But I have, it is at the maximum volume according to this thing. And
maybe you could like take the mask off.
I don't think that will help. Maybe that will help a little, okay, help a little bit. But there we go. Let's, so I guess if I get it right up top, maybe. There's no other mic here. So, let's see, is this any better? No, probably not. Yeah, I guess I will try to speak loudly, and I will wonder if there's other mic solution here. Oh, these. This is probably what I should do instead. Okay, so let's see. You're on? Really? Okay, that is, wow. I guess that's better. And we'll do that. We'll do this, but I should not need to swallow this mic. But that's what we'll do to deal with the volume level, since it at least is functional. Okay. So that's going to be one topic, is this automating building software. And another topic we're going to want to talk about, and kind of one of our big themes, is going to be lots of things related to sharing machines. So in CSO1, you kind of learn this very simple model of a computer that runs kind of one thing at a time. We run a program, we read an instruction, we get the next instruction, and so on. But we know that our typical machines don't work that way. They can multiple things, possibly, in the case of something like Portal, for multiple different users, and we need to make that work in some way. And there's a bunch of aspects to this. So some of this is, how do we safely share a machine between multiple programs and multiple users? There's a bunch of resources we need to share to make that work. And we're going to talk about some big ideas and kind of the most common way of allowing us to share machines between different programs. And we kind of have two resources to manage. So if you think of your assembly, in your assembly programs, you have your instructions and your data in memory, and those need to run on the CPU, and those need to store their information in registers and in the stack and other memory locations you have. So our two primary resources are going to be access to run things on the CPU, so we're going to have to share that in some way, and access to memory to store things like the stack and other persistent data that your program has. And the strategy that we're going to talk about for storing the persistent data for things in memory is there's going to be this idea called address translation, sometimes also called, more specifically, virtual memory. So when your program, and I'm calling it in the slide a process, as we'll learn, a process is a term we'll have for one instance of a program. So if I start a program on Portal and you start the same program on Portal, we have two processes running the same program. So each instance is called a process. So each process, each instance of a program, is going to have its own addresses that are virtual addresses, meaning they aren't real. And specifically, the way they're not going to be real is that the OS is going to make some decision about how they map to the real addresses. So every time our process is running, every time it's jumping to a function or accessing a pointer. All those addresses it's using are going to be these virtual addresses. It's never going to see the real addresses. And the OS is going to have set up this mapping that takes these virtual addresses and maps them to the real addresses, which we'll learn we'll call physical addresses. And this mapping, you know, will have the main effect is that, well, the OS decides what the program can access. If I don't have a line through the mapping, I can't use that part of memory. So if process A wants to access process B's code, well, we don't have any way to get there. Because it has to start over here and somehow end up there. There's nothing that I said, there's no way it can do that. So we're going to end up having isolation. Another thing this mapping lets us do is we can really decouple the addresses the program uses from what the real machine provides. So we can choose whatever addresses we want over here, and we can have a whole lot of them if we want. And that's, in fact, a common thing to do, that we'll just have this huge amount of addresses, and programs can use whatever addresses they want. And the OS can make whatever addresses they want work, even though the physical addresses that work is probably pretty constrained. And we can have these big virtual addresses, and the program can say, I want my stack at address 7F00000, and we're not going to care if that's too much space, because it could be anywhere, depending on what the OS decides. That even if we have a small number of physical addresses, we can just assign them to all these random numbers the program is written to use. And one thing we're going to have to talk about is how do we store this mapping? And we're going to go into great detail about the specific format that this mapping has and who implements it. So this is a feature that's going to be kind of cooperative between operating systems and processors. We can't just implement it in the operating system because when we run normal instructions, we're going to go through this mapping. There has to be special processor support for that. But this mapping is going to be maintained by the operating system, and we're going to have some particular challenges in storing it. It's going to turn out that we want to store these really big, complex mappings, but that's going to be slow. So we need some way of speeding that up, and we're going to go to one of our later topics of caching to speed that up, that we're going to have kind of some of the mappings stored in this really fast memory, but most of it stored somewhere else in order to make it efficient. That usually we want the processor to really quickly figure out what the mapping is, but we can't actually do that when the mapping has like 1,000 entries, which is not uncommon. You think of like a program you're running that has gigabytes of stuff in memory. And so our solution is going to be that we store the frequently used things in this fast memory, and hopefully it's the right frequently used things. So we'll talk about how that works and, you know, what the OS does and what the processor does to make that happen. And I alluded to that this mapping, in addition to letting us kind of give the program whatever addresses it wants and deal with this large memory, it allows us to efficiently run multiple processes alongside each other. That we can just give them different mappings when they run. So the OS will set one mapping for process A, one mapping for process B. So if you and I both log into Portal and both run Vim, we'll have two instances of Vim that don't share things. They'll just have independent memory, even though they're the same program, because they're different processes. And we're going to actually want to, you know, run programs that kind of take turns on a physical core. So we have a processor core that runs a sequence of instructions, and if we have, you know, 100 people logged into Portal and 20 cores, we probably need to share some of those cores between people. And that's, in fact, what the operating system's going to do. We're going to share a core between people, and the way we're going to do that is that we're going to switch between processes on a single core. And part of that switching is going to be choosing which mapping is active. And as we're going to learn later, that switch is going to be called a context switch. And you might say, what's a context? Well, a context is going to include, among other things, this mapping. And we're going to decide when we switch from my program to your program, we're going to put your program's mapping in place. We switch back to mine, we're going to put my program's mapping in place. Some other things we're going to learn have to happen with this mapping is that, well, we want to actually have some stuff the operating system manages be accessible in these normal processes, but we're going to want to protect that from normal programs. So one thing we're going to learn about is this idea called kernel mode, that the hardware is going to have some extra support to help the operating system do things like access shared resources without giving every program the ability to do that. If we think of like files on disk, the operating system needs to access stuff that's related to multiple people's files on disk, but we need to make sure that a random program can't access stuff related to multiple people's files on disk. And the hardware is going to help support this with this idea called kernel mode, where basically we're going to let the operating system code run with more access than normal programs. And that operating system code is going to ensure that programs don't do things they aren't supposed to do, but the operating system can still access things that are shared between programs, like, say, the directory that contains everyone's multiple people's files. And in this memory mapping, we'll see that, oh, it turns out that the mapping, in addition to letting us specify different memory regions, lets us specify properties of them. And the way to think about it is that if the hardware is looking at this mapping anyways, it can check some other things along the way. One thing it can check is, well, who's accessing it, and it can change the mapping based on that. And that's, in fact, what they do. So we have these mappings that only work for the OS when the OS is running, but not when the program is running normal code. Another thing we have here is we have this trigger exception box. So one thing we're going to learn about hardware supporting to allow us to run multiple programs alongside each other is that sometimes we need to inform the operating system of interesting events. And one type of interesting event is when your program accesses some memory that isn't allocated properly. And in this case, we can't just keep running the instructions we were running. We have to jump to somewhere else to handle that. And that special jump to somewhere else is called an exception. That's going to run the OS to decide what do we do about this program that, in this case, accessed memory that wasn't in the mapping. And the OS gets to decide what to do. So one thing the OS could do is maybe the OS could say, oh, well, let's load that memory for you because you probably should have it. Or the OS could decide, oh, you made a mistake, let me crash you, and maybe trigger a sequence of events that will cause the message segmentation fault to appear on your screen. So questions about this address space idea? And is my volume manageable? Okay, I am annoyed that I have such bad volume here with the mic maxed out. I don't know why that things are bad. Okay, so we talked about sharing memory, and I alluded to sharing the processor, and that's gonna be another one of our big issues. And in addition to talking about running two different programs on a processor, we're also gonna be talking about just doing multiple things at once. Either actually doing multiple things at once, what we'll call parallelism, like doing two things in parallel, and appearing to do multiple things at once, even if we're kind of simulating that. And the big way this is going to work is that we're going to share the time on the processor, that we aren't going to follow the simple model of we run one instruction and then we advance the PC to the next instruction, or unless it's like a jump. We're going to have some kind of special jumps to the OS, where the OS might switch to other programs. And the most common case where this will happen is when we're thinking about input and output. So if I write a program, in this case, readInput.exe, that waits for a key press, when I run that program, the program is going to ask the OS, using a mechanism we'll learn is called a system call, to say, hey, I'd like to read something. And the OS gets to run, and it's not just going to ask, check the keyboard for input in a loop. It's going to say, okay, I have better things to do right now than checking the keyboard for input. It's going to run something else. So in this example, say SSH and Firefox get to run for a bit while I'm waiting to press, while the read input is waiting for me to press a key. And sometime later, the operating system gets to run again, possibly, as we'll learn, triggered by the key press. There will be a way for devices like the keyboard to cause the OS to run sooner than it would otherwise. And it will switch back to the read input program. So we're going to talk about this kind of mechanism for allowing the OS to coordinate I/O and to, importantly, keep our processors from being idle when we actually have work to do. And the key mechanism for this is that we can switch from one program to another rather than just waiting to do something that one program wants to do that doesn't really use the processor. Waiting for a key press, we don't need to run something on the processor to do that. We can just do stuff, and a key press happens, and then we handle it. And that is, in fact, what operating systems try really hard to do, not just for key presses, but like for input from the network, for input from hard drives, and so on. And this kind of idea is called time multiplexing, that that our program might think, oh, we have the whole processor, but actually what happens is my program here, in this example, a loop program, it's running a big loop, it doesn't get to use the processor forever because we're going to make sure that it shares that processor with other programs. And so our loop is running, and let's say here, it gets to this instruction, there's going to be a way where the OS can stop the program and run some other things. And from the perspective of the program, what it looks like happens is it's running some assembly instructions, and then one of those instructions takes a really, really long time. So in this example, if we look at these two, if we we're checking the time, it's going to be this huge gap, this not much work. Because what's actually happening is the processor is spending some time running some other programs because the OS configured things that to happen. We'll talk about what are the mechanisms by which the OS can do that. But something I want to get across here is that these mechanisms for sharing memory and the CPU, they kind of give programs the illusion that they have their own machine. So we taught you this model in CS01 of how a processor works and how memory works. And the reason that works for your programs is that our virtual memory and this time multiplexing give your programs that illusion. Even though there's other programs running, you don't see them. It looks like you have a processor that just runs each instruction one after the other. Yeah, the timing's a little weird, but it just runs one instruction, then the next, like you learned how assembly works. You have a memory that looks like a big array. It's not actually implemented that way because of this address mapping, but it looks like a big array. So all this provides the programs the illusion that they're kind of running alone on a system, even though we're implementing it by sharing all these resources of a system. So questions about this kind of shared and the illusion of a dedicated machine idea? Okay, so one thing that we're going to talk about in this class that's going to kind of break this illusion of a dedicated machine is that we're going to want to have our programs do multiple things at once. So most processors these days have multiple cores. And this time multiplexing is still going to happen with multiple cores. You might say, why? Well, I mentioned Portal, right? If Portal has 20 cores and we have 100 students logged in, probably we need to share those cores. We can't actually like give each student a core. And even on sort of a more modest machine, you know, we might run multiple programs at once and possibly more programs than there are cores, so they'll share it. And also, some programs are going to make use of more than one core. So in this example here, you know, we've divided up the work for each of the cores, and it turns out we have this one program that appears to be doing things on multiple different cores. And we're going to learn a mechanism for doing this called threads, where we'll have one process that has multiple sequences of execution. And a simple way of thinking about this is I told you that time multiplexing gave you this illusion of a dedicated processor. So instead of giving you the illusion of a dedicated processor, we'll give you the illusion of two or three or four or five or however many you like dedicated processors. And they'll be implemented by actually putting each of your threads, your pretend processors, on real cores at various times. So in this example, Firefox has two threads, and they happen to actually run at the same time, but they're still sharing the system with all these other programs. And we could even have Firefox have more threads than there are cores, and that would be fine, because, well, what would we do? We just say run, you know, the other Firefox thing in some other slot. And we're going to spend a bunch of time talking about sort of how, not only sort of how these threads work, but a challenge that we're going to come up with when dealing with threads is that coordinating these programs that share memory has some special challenges that we don't see in sort of normal programs that only use a single thread. So another aspect of sharing machines that we're going to talk about a bit is about dealing with multiple users. So I kind of focused on multiple programs, and everything we've done for multiple programs helps with multiple users because usually two users are running different programs. But we also have to deal with users needing to be isolated from each other in the way that programs aren't. So for example, if you log into Portal and try to access other people's files, it's not supposed to work. If you try to log into Portal and shut down the machine, it's not supposed to work. So we're going to talk about what are the mechanisms to implement these kind of policies that different users of a system have different access. And then we're going to especially talk about this in terms of files, where often we have lots of complicated things we want to do with files as far as who can access what files. With like the shutdown command, it's fairly simple, right? There's like a small list of users who should do that. But with files, like often it's like these files, this set of users should access this other files, this other set of users, and we need some mechanism to make that tractable to allow us to share files in a controlled manner. Okay. That gets us to our fourth sort of major theme. So I talked about these themes that are kind of about single systems. And we have a theme on networking. So in CS01, I think most of you did something with sockets. I understand some of you did not take CS01 here and probably therefore didn't. So I'm going to talk about what a socket is for those people and for everyone who's forgotten everything in CS01. So a socket is a connection from one program to another. And by connection, I mean it's kind of like you're typing in input to one program and receiving output from it, like if you were running it in a terminal, but over a network. Sockets are how like SSH works. So SSH opens a socket to Portal in your typical case, and that lets it communicate back and forth with a program on Portal. And in CSO1, you did the socket chat lab, at least some of you, that use sockets, and sockets are fairly simple to use. There's some lots of boilerplate that maybe is a little confusing. We're gonna talk about sort of what's going on underneath and hopefully make some of that boilerplate slightly less confusing, though that's not gonna be our main focus. It's mostly gonna be on sort of what are the kind of mechanisms to implement that type of networking. But ultimately what we want to get is that I can do something like SSH. I can connect a program on one machine to a program on another machine, and they can send bytes back and forth. How do we actually implement that on top of the network, and how does the network work? And a big thing we'll talk about is that, well, the network is not kind of designed as a monolith. We don't implement SSH and that's it. We implement lots of things. And to accommodate that, we have what is known as a layered design. That we've divided up the things the network needs to do into these separate layers, and the higher layers are implemented by calling the lower layers. So, for example, SSH doesn't implement the functionality of reliably getting data from one machine to another. That is handled by TCP. So what SSH does is it calls TCP via the sockets interface, and it implements other functionality, like knowing what's a command prompt and what's not, and handling logins. And TCP knows how to handle getting data reliably from one place to another, but it doesn't actually know how to deal with the part of like figuring out how to send it, what direction to send it to the machine. That's handled by the layer down, IP. So TCP calls the IP functions to do that work, rather than having its own implementation of that. And the big advantage of this is that we can have kind of lots of things at this application layer that share this common functionality at the lower layers, and we can also have lots of different implementations of some of these lower layers that handle different types of networks. So I talked about our application layer is kind of like these application-defined meanings, like for SSH, knowing what's a login, knowing what's a command prompt, and what's a file transfer versus a command prompt. The transport layer is just, how do I get the data from A to B? It doesn't know what the data means, it just gets data from A to B. We have our network layer, which is about how do I get to the right machine? If I'm connecting from, you know, California to here, how do we make that the data get from California to Virginia? That's the network layer's job. And then we have this link layer, which is, well, if we're all on the same Wi-Fi, how do we decide how we use that Wi-Fi radio, right? We have this common radio channel. How do we coordinate that between all the machines on the Wi-Fi and make that work? That's that link layer's responsibility. And then we have the question of, well, I have this Wi-Fi radio, how do I actually encode bits as radio signals? And they have a physical layer for that. So we're gonna talk about kind of this layer design, and we're gonna talk maybe in more detail about the basics of how we implement this reliability idea. And we're gonna talk a bit about sort of how we specify machines for these different layers. So questions about kind of the basics of these layers. So one concept that's going to come up when we talk about networks that I think comes up a bunch of places is kind of this notion of names versus addresses. And it's especially important in the networking world, but we've seen it before. So like in your C program, you can have a variable called counter, and you know that when it makes it to machine code, that's not how it looks. Like, the processor doesn't know what counter is. It instead knows an address or maybe a register. And we're gonna have this distinction between names and addresses come up a bunch in networks, and we're gonna talk about that, where we have these logical names, like www.virginia.edu, and those names are great, but they're not what the sort of actual implementation of the network wants to use. And this is just like, in our case of our variable counter, The variable, the name counter, is not what the machine code wants to use. You can't put a string in most machine code instructions for a variable name. You have to put an address or something like that, or a register identifier. So we have some other format that the actual hardware wants, and we're going to have something similar with the network, that the network doesn't want to deal with these names that we like, wants to deal with these addresses. And as we'll learn, there's kind of these different types of addresses. So we have addresses for the network layer, these IP addresses, and we also have addresses for the link layer. These serve the same purpose, but at different layers, we have, you know, different functionality being implemented, and therefore a different way of assigning these numbers. And we also have the same concept in some other parts of networking. So like you say I'm connecting via SSH, but we can't actually send a string when asking what to connect to on most systems. We have to use a number. We'll learn that these are port numbers. And the purpose of these port numbers is to identify the right program. If I have a web server that I can SSH into, it needs to know, am I trying to get a web page or am I trying to SSH? The port number is how that's done. And we have this similar thing where we have the names for the ports versus the actual numbers, because that's not, we're sending not names, but numbers over the network. Just like in our machine code, we have numbers, not names. So another topic we're going to talk about with sockets is about secure communication. So sockets are going to let us connect to a particular program, but if we're thinking about some malicious adversary, that might not be good enough. That we want to get assurance that when I open up a connection to, say, google.com, or, you know, to be more strict, like Gmail, I want to know I'm actually connected to Gmail and not someone who's going to steal my password. How do we provide that functionality? And we're going to talk about the kind of main way that that happens, and that's kind of somewhat orthogonal to network, because it's going to turn out we're going to use a bunch of math and a bunch of kind of public infrastructure mixed in with that to make that happen. So questions about topics so far? Yes. Question is, I said here that HTTPS is 443. Does that mean that it always uses that port number? No. And we'll talk about this later when we talk about, way later in the semester when we talk about URIs. But so typically we have this way that you may have seen of specifying a website, or a URI, or specifying a resource, I should say, generic term, because it can be used for more than websites. And this syntax has a way of identifying the machine you want to connect to. And you can identify the machine you want to connect to with just that DNS name, or you can also provide a port number. So for example here, if I make my handwriting not impossibly messy, I'm saying to connect to port 8433 instead of 433, even though kind of the default for HTTPS is 443. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Other questions? Okay, so the final big topic we'll talk about is things that fast processors do. So in CS01, we learned this model that what a processor does is it takes an instruction from memory, reads it in, it does what the instruction says. Maybe that requires accessing registers or accessing memory, and then it goes on to the next instruction. And that's a great model of a processor, because assembly language is designed to look like that's what's happening. But Since the early processors with more modern ones over the past 50, 60 years, processor designers kind of cheat. And the processors don't actually do all those steps quite like that. They do some different things. And there's kind of two big different things they'll do that we'll talk about. So one is caching. That in that model, it seems like every time we access an instruction, we go to memory to get it. And every time an instruction like needs to like do something with the stack, it has to go to memory to access that piece of the stack, has to modify it, has to send that to memory. That works, but it's slow. So we have this idea called caching, where we have the real memory, and we have some other small, fast memory called a cache. The second big idea that we'll use is that in that model, if we have a bunch of instructions, we do the first instruction, then we wait after it finishes, we do the second instruction, then the third instruction, and that works. But often we have some instructions we can kind of do multiple parts of together. So one way we can do multiple parts of instructions together is, let's say I have, you know, a function with 10 instructions. Wouldn't it be great for me to fetch all of those instructions all together? And processors say, yeah, let's do that. Let's fetch more than one instruction at a time, because I probably need all of them. And we can also say, oh, if I have this instruction that adds to something and this instruction that does arithmetic with something completely different, we can run them at the same time if we have two things to do it. And that is, in fact, a thing that modern processors do. So talking about caching, so to kind of illustrate like the importance of this in processors, here is a 20-year-old picture of a single-core processor. Why am I using a 20-year-old picture? Because it's hard to find newer pictures of single-core processors. There aren't many of them. So this is a high-performance desktop single-core processor from 2004. A kind of modern processor is basically, you know, if it's a four-core processor, it's probably four of these stapled together with some more cache. And this picture, also convenient to find things from that are 20 years old, labels the parts of this processor core. So if we think about our execution, we have this part labeled fetch, scan, align, microcode. This is where the fetch an instruction and figure out what it does step is implemented. And where does that fetch the instruction from? Well, in our kind of naive CSO1 model, it's memory. Here, it fetches it from this instruction cache here. That's where it gets the instruction from. Then we have to execute the instruction. And that's going to happen depending on the instruction type in these execution units. This is where our ALUs are. Or in this floating point unit, if it's a floating point instruction, because it turns out most processors have separate hardware for floating point stuff. Or if it's a load or store in this load store unit, and you might say, okay, so that load store unit, that's going to access memory, right? That's what a move from memory does. Well, no, it's going to access this data cache. Now, we have a problem here, which is that, well, I guess we have two issues. So one issue is I told you where we access things from memory. I didn't say where the registers are. So in this processor, the register file is basically here and here. There's one in the execution units and one next to the floating point units. They did that because we want registers to be super fast. How do we make them super fast? Well, one way is that there's not many of them, right? We know registers, there's a small number. Another way is we put them right next to where they're needed. So that's what they've done. They're right next to the ALUs. And we follow that same philosophy with our instruction cache and data cache, that they're right next to where they're needed. But the problem is, we can't fit all the data in that small data cache. Remember, this is a microscope photograph of a processor. It's really tiny. And the same thing with the instruction cache. We can't fit the entire program in the instruction cache. So what's going to happen is that, well, sometimes we're going to ask for some instruction or some data, and it's not going to be there. So when that's the case, we're going to go to this second cache here, this L2 cache, and hope it's there. And the L2 cache, that looks pretty big. And it is relatively big. But sometimes our data is not going to be there, so we're going to have to go to main memory. And this part of the chip here at the edge, well, this whole thing at the edge, this is going to go to some memory that is outside the chip, that's physically separate. And that's going to happen only when it's not in the L2 cache. But the idea here is that hopefully we can usually avoid going to that slow memory. And what this gives us is what's called a memory hierarchy. That we start with our registers, then we go down to this level one cache. That's our data cache and our instruction cache. And hopefully we find our data there. And if not, we go to the L2 cache. And on the modern processor, we would then go to an L3 cache. In 2004, there wasn't much reason to have L3 caches. This, the way the numbers worked out these days, there is. Sometimes there's even an L4 cache. And then we go to main memory. And what's the reason why we have all these small memories if we have to sometimes go to main memory? Well, they're so much faster that we'd really like to just go to registers. That's like less than a nanosecond. And things get orders of magnitude slower as we go down this list. So we're going to talk about how these caches work and how we can make it so usually we can stay near the top of this hierarchy, even though we don't nearly have enough room to fit everything in the top of this hierarchy. And a second, I mentioned also we have the issue of processors doing things with how instructions are executed. So I have an example here. So here I have two programs, and I have a loop that runs 10 billion times. So I'm setting a register to 10 billion with that move instruction, and there's a dec instruction which decrements it, and as long as it's greater than or equal to zero, we go back to the top of each loop. So these are loops that count down from 10 billion to zero, which means that the left loop runs 30 billion instructions. And the right loop is the same thing, except I have an additional add in there. It runs 40 billion instructions. And on my desktop, these take the exact same amount of time to run. So what's going on there? Well, what's going on is that my processor knows that these two instructions here, these two adds, are independent of each other, and it has not just one ALU, but a whole bunch of them. And it runs both of those adds at the same time, so the extra add is free. You know, when it was running the left loop, it just was leaving an ALU unused while it was waiting to go to the next iteration. So we're going to talk about how do we implement this kind of functionality, and hopefully that will let us think about, you know, what sort of weird performance am I going to see from these processors where I can't just count the instructions? And we're going to learn, you know, the caches are one reason we can't just count instructions, and these sort of parallelism, these running two things at once, is another reason why if we just count instructions, we won't have the right intuition about what our program's performance is like. Some questions about any of my sort of high-level themes we're covering this semester. Okay, so as a practical matter, we should talk about C. So most of our assignments in this class are going to be in C. And in theory, you all know C from CS01 or whatever equivalent course you took. I know in practice, things are more complicated. And we're going to try to focus in particular on pointers, which are definitely the topic people have had the most trouble with historically in this class. So to start out, here's an exercise. Here's some C code. I want to know what's the value of array after the C code runs, or does it just not run at all? And you can talk with your neighbors, decide what you think about it. I'll ask for your answer in a minute or two. Would like some more time, and hopefully I found the gain control on the lavalier mic. So hopefully you can hear me. Good, okay. There is in fact a knob for that, just hidden. Okay, so let's see, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, no clue? Okay, so I think B is our plurality answer, followed by no clue. So let's go through how this works. So we have this first line here, and at array 0, we could also have written with parentheses around the array 0. It takes array 0 and gets its address, which means that our pointer P points to this 10 here in the array. Then we do P plus equals 2. And the rule for pointers in C is that when we do addition or subtraction of the pointers, it moves the pointers by units of the size of what it points to, the things it points to. In this case, to figure out what the pointer points to, we say, oh, it's declared as a pointer to int. So this is a pointer to int, and that means that p plus 2 is equal to p advanced by 2 ints. So we advance it by units of what it points to. In assembly, this is going to mean that the, you know, we're going to do an add of 2 times the size of int to something to implement this in assembly. And so what that's going to mean is that now p is not going to point to the 10. We're going to advance it by 2 ints, and it's going to point to the 30. So then we try to use p like an array. And arrays and pointers in C are kind of mostly interchangeable, not completely. But as far as indexing works, they are. So a pointer acts like an array that starts at that location. So we have an array that starts at the 30. Array of 0 is 30. Array of 1 would be 40, and so on. So P is our array that we pretend starts at the 30. So P of 1 is 40, the 40. Because kind of our virtual array here is that this is P of 0. I'll draw. P of 0 is exactly that, and P of 1 is exactly the 40. I'm not drawing an arrow because P of 0 dereferences it. It's not a pointer anymore. It's the actual value. And P of 1 is the actual value, that 40 in the array. And we're changing that value by adding 1 to it, so that's how we get 41. So questions on how I figured it out? Yes, back there.
I just want to confirm, so when you do brackets, that also, or like brackets position 0 or position 1, that also dereferences it, right? Not just doing a star.
When I do brackets, that dereferences it? Yes. And there's a general rule in C that may or may not help you, is that the x, y is defined to be the same, is the same as dereference x plus y. And like, this is literally the rule, even in cases you think wouldn't make sense. Like, by cases that wouldn't make sense, I mean like that two array works because it's defined this way. Don't ever do that. Like, I'll just use sort of bad style, but it works because that's how array indexing is defined. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Yeah.
At what point are pointers and arrays like not interchangeable?
At what point are pointers and arrays not interchangeable? The most notable example is if you take the size of an array, it takes into account how many much stuff is in the array. You take the size of a pointer, it's how big is the address. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, back there.
You say x of y is the same as dereference x plus y. Do you mean to multiply y by
so when I say x plus y is the same as dereference, the quantity x plus y, do I mean to multiply y by the size that's stored there? So that multiplication happens if x is a pointer, but that happens as a consequence of the plus operation. So, and we know this in this example, right? This is why this line worked in this example, is that the plus 2 took into account that it was ints. And that's why it advanced to the 30 instead of by just 2 bytes, for example. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there.
So for line 3, would it have been the same thing as you did and sign star array?
For line 3, this line, if I did p equals at array?
At star array?
Yes, I believe that would, if that compiles, that would be the same. And also the same would be just writing p equals array. Other questions? Okay. So let's do a trickier exercise. Again, you can talk with your neighbors as you figure things out. Okay, in the interest of time, I'll ask for opinions here. I'd normally give a little more time, but I underestimated how slow I was going. So let's start with A, who thinks A, that we have some sort of compile or runtime error here. B, C, D, E, F, no clue. Okay, so we have a plurality on, I think, D. Let's go through what happens in this code. So I have this Q here, and what Q does is I set it to array 2, so Q is going to end up pointing to the first element of array 2. Q is a pointer to pointer, array 2 is an array of pointers, so that makes sense. Then we pass Q to P, so I have P here, which is a copy of the address in foo, so it also points to the same place. We just copied the address, we copied that box from one to the other. and we're dereferencing P, which means that we're modifying what P points to. So we're modifying that part of array one. And we're setting it equal to the address of array one index two, which is this 30. So this points to that 30 after the assignment in mystery. So then, out of the function, we are going to dereference Q, which gets the value of this box here, and we're going to try to put it in array one of one in this 20. And what's the value of that box? That's going to be, this is going to be the address of array one of two. So our possible answers are none of the above, that it's going to end up being 10, 10, and some address, or sorry, 10, 10, some address 30 and 40. And that address will probably not be 30. It will probably be some massive, annoying number. Or we get a compile or runtime error because this assignment converts an int pointer to int without a cast. And we would have gotten the answer you expected if we just added another star. Most of you expected if we added another star, so you had the right idea, just little bookkeeping error. But fortunately, if we run our compilers with warnings on, it will tell us about. So please do that. So questions about this? Example. Okay, so I have to go over some logistics. So let's talk about some logistics. That's important. So starting next week, not tomorrow, but next week, we're going to have labs. The way labs work in this class are that you can preferably go to lab in person at the time you signed up for and do the lab, possibly with partners, and get checked off by a TA. If you get checked off by a TA, you'll know if you got full credit for the lab or not. Most, but not all labs, will allow you to just submit something and we'll grade what you submit. Generally, if you submit something, we don't care if you attend the lab. The grading of things you submit will be more strict than checkoffs, because we don't know if you actually worked. We can't ask you questions about what happened in a prompt manner and so on. Also, if you work in lab in person and don't complete the lab, but you were actually working and the TA doesn't think you were just like playing some computer game or working on a homework for a different class, then you should get checked off for at least 50% credit even if you don't complete the lab. This policy does not apply to submissions because it's much harder for us to tell if your submission is the result of actually working or not if you aren't in person. There are a small number of labs which basically require attendance, where logistically it is not possible to do if you aren't physically there. If you are sick or something, contact me and we'll figure something out. But other than sort of special circumstances, sickness, religious issues, personal issues, you know, we expect you to be there. And if you can't make a normal lab, we can often make exceptions or provide some other accommodations if it's something like you're sick or some other special circumstance, not just I had a lot of work for another class. Just let me know. Labs mostly allow collaboration, and we'd like you to collaborate. When you do, please make sure when you submit code files and the like, you know, if you do that, have them mention who you work with. No, don't hide that. We don't We don't intend to monitor which lab you attend. However, some of the labs are very close to capacity. And if the lab is full and you weren't registered for the lab, we're going to tell you to leave. We also have homework assignments. Unlike the labs, the homeworks are individual assignments. They are generally due on Fridays. There are tentative dates for the homeworks on the schedule. The first homework is some practice with C. That isn't due in a couple weeks after we've covered. We also deals with make files. I'll tell you about that build automation, which is why it's not due immediately, but you could probably start it now. When you submit things to the submission site, we have some automatic testing. I'd like to just make some notes about that. The automatic testing may have some delay because we don't test if lots of people submit. Some of the tests take a while to run, especially for some of the later assignments. And sometimes you might not have the program set up if you submit very early. If the testing program doesn't understand or can't test something, we'll just leave it for manual grading. That might mean it's wrong. It might mean that we just didn't anticipate all the possibilities in the testing. My intention is that the testing results are not surprises. The tests are not meant to be gotchas. Yes, some surprising test results might happen. But it's not my intention that there's some hidden information in the test that's not in the assignment. If you think the testing program made a mistake, please submit a regrade. That might happen sometimes. As I mentioned, we have our warm-up assignment. It's due in a few weeks that you could start on now if you wanted to. You probably can't do the makefile part yet, but you could do the rest, hopefully, if you remember / review CSO1 stuff. So we also have quizzes, which will be released after Thursday lecture starting next week. I know it's this week on the schedule. That will be fixed. They will be due before the 12:30 p.m. lecture. So there's two sections of CSO2. We're going to share most assignments. That means we're probably sharing quizzes. The quizzes may be discussed in the 12:30 p.m. CSO2, so they'll be due before that lecture, because otherwise we might just be spouting off answers, and we don't want the quizzes open while that happens. We'll talk more about those next week. And I should just say, yes, I didn't get through all of this. I should talk about sort of sharing lectures. So there are two sections of CSO2. There's mine and Skadron's. We intend to share assignments, labs, homeworks, and so on. We tend to stay roughly in sync. But we might have slightly different quizzes for both sections. If necessary, we might have, so on. But probably, otherwise, we're basically sharing the course and we intend to stay in sync and basically use mostly the same slides and so on. Yes, and I'm out of time, so I've gone over everything I need to go over. Everything else is on the syllabus. And we'll probably talk about this next time.